Once again, yes, indeed, here I am. John J. Harper is my guest. And while he's taking kind of a metaphysical approach to the events unfolding before all of our eyes right now, that's fine. We do two different types of shows on these events. One is pure science, and the other is the metaphysical. Now, interestingly, both of these types of guests are beginning to mesh in their points of view, if not the reasons and the evidence that they present for them. They're really beginning to say the same things. I wonder how many of you have noticed that. More from John in a moment. So, John, do you think that with this increased solar activity will come outbreaks of bird flu-like viruses emerging right and left more than we can handle?
Well, what I'm sensing, and that is from, you know, keeping up with the medical research community, is that we're right on the cusp of seeing at least an initial bird-to-human consistent outbreak, and then perhaps which might ratchet up to, you know, the higher level where human-to-human contagion begins. And, of course, you know, there's a lot of very, very concerned folks looking into this, but I have to tell you that one of the people that I interviewed a number of years ago very spontaneously said to me in a counseling session, this person did have a near-death experience, by the way, John, you're going to see a lot of death in your lifetime. And I thought, you know, do I pursue this or I let it go? And I said, well, you mean, are you concerned about nuclear war? And they said, no. And I said, oh, you mean my family? And they said, no, not necessarily. And I said, well, can you be more specific? And they said, well, there's going to be pandemics. They did not say bird flu. They said pandemics. I didn't pursue it. And so, you know, I wish I had. But my point here is that I think that everything considered, if we look, you know, at the, again, I try to integrate science and the metaphysical, the physics and the metaphysics equally now, and that's because I've had this tremendous mixture of life experiences. So, you know, Carl Jung said, you know, he didn't believe in anything. He didn't really have faith. He only had knowledge. He said when he knew something from his personal experience, then he could speak to it, and I guess that's where, you know, I am tonight, Art.
Anything else from your period of communication with Mother Earth, if that's the way you want to put it, that we should know about?
Well, you know, let me clarify that a little bit. What I understood at the moment of that telepathic communication was that I was in this huge energetic influence, you might say, and it was almost like being in a bubble of energy. It was very you know, it's hard to describe. It's not that mystical. It would be like being in a large energetic field that you're not being shocked from. You can it's almost the snap, crackle, pop of being in a high power transmitter environment, which I know you know about as a ham radio operator, and the reason we ground equipment. But the point is that I knew that this was nothing, quote, metaphysical in one sense, but it was the way the world worked if you could tune into it. I also sensed that this was probably had something to do with being part of the north-south electromagnetic field itself or the magnetosphere, and I still think that. And in fact, one time I had another individual who shared some insight from their near-death experience. I asked him, where do you think you went? Where did you see your relatives? Where, you know, did you go to heaven, for example? And they said, oh, I know where heaven is. And I said, well, please share that with me. They said, oh, it's in the magnetosphere around this planet. And I said, interesting. So again, you know, one more layer to this story.
All right. But again, my question was, you said you had the presence of mind to ask questions.
Yeah.
And you got answers.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in what those were and what the answers were.
Well, some of them are not, you know, not too savory because I asked about the future, and I was given not only this telepathic voice in my head, which was crystal clear, by the way, there was no ambiguity whatsoever. I was being communicated with as much as you hear folks such as Daniel Pinchbeck talk about his 2012 experiences on ayahuasca, or Graham Hancock talk about his experiences with, you know, ayahuasca or dimethyltryptamine. Or
all right. Well, if it was frank and open and direct, then pass it on to us in that fashion.
It said that there would be cataclysms, that there would be earth changes that were going to be very dramatic, that the weather would shift, that the oceans would roar, in essence, and that tidal waves or tsunamis would strike both the west and the east United States coast. And, you know, the time event I was not given. It did not link to 2012. I was just told and shown. There were some type of visual imagery to this. And it was just basically like you're watching the Weather Channel on a bad day, you know, where just every kind of event that you can imagine would hit you at once.
And so what has that produced in your life? In other words, for you, John, and your family, based on what you've seen, what will you do?
I'll share one quick experience that was not part of that, but another vision that made me move to where I am today.
Where are you, by the way?
I'm in Spokane, Washington.
All right.
About 300 some miles off the Pacific coast. I grew up in the Seattle, Washington area, where I retired from the Navy as an engineer and as a mental health counselor. I was right at the base, you might say. Actually, from my office, I could see the base of Mount Rainier. And June of 1994, I had an open vision, a spontaneous vision. This is all part of this long process of metaphysical experiences that I share in my book that I had, and I tie them in more coherently than I am this evening. But the point is that I saw Mount Rainier erupt, and it was such a visual and such an emotional impact on me that I really became concerned about that. And so I actually accepted early retirement, and this was in June of 94. I moved to Spokane because I wanted off the coastline, number one. I wanted away from that mountain, and I grew up at the base of that mountain. So, I mean, I was intimately experienced with it, and I shouldn't have any kind of concern about that because I always thought it was just a very dormant volcano. But that is the reason I came to Spokane. Now, however, let me extend that. I'm also contemplating now going to another region of this country because I'm very concerned about what I see as an imminent ice age, or at least a mini ice age, that's going to really change the climate so dramatically that, again, food and feeding ourselves is going to become extremely important, in my opinion. And I believe in the short term, that's where the resources of our government should be focused. But, you know, realistically, I realize the system doesn't move that quickly, and I've got all these kids and grandkids. I'm going to try to make wise decisions based on, you know, all these experiences I've had in my life, and so I probably will move more towards the central part of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, if there's anything that we should have learned lately from disaster after disaster, it is do not depend on the government. You have only yourself to depend on. If a disaster occurs, they will not be there for you.
Isn't that the truth?
Yes.
We saw that with Katrina, and we can, I imagine, assume that, you know, for example, a compounding of these crises, for example, if we just lost satellites to solar flare events, if we simply had a massive earthquake or other natural disaster, which we have all the time anyway, but if we had all of these cyclic events, you might say, concentrate in a very short time period, we can only imagine that we would be on our own for a long time.
I do imagine that's possible, John. And so you are preparing for that?
Yes, I have talked with some other like-minded people that are in the professional community, doctors and other folks like that. And there are different communities that are now starting to become sensitive to earth changes. And I'm not talking about in a sense of running to a secluded area and trying to hide from society. These are folks that are very well entrenched in communities around this country in professions, but have sensed, and we just found each other here in the last few weeks, couple months, so it's been an ongoing teleconference email exchange, and there's a lot of us going to, I think, find an area, in the central U.S. somewhere, that we can form a new community that be very much like an old community, only we're going to try to become more self-sufficient. Of course, we've had what we call intentional communities now all over, but this will be trying to use every bit of wisdom that we've collected together and share, you know, common things that we can, so that we can help our families through the what we feel is going to be a very serious climate change.
Okay, let me ask you a very sensitive question, John. It sounds like you're really in touch with something beyond yourself. I guess that's fair to say, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You're preparing for what you consider to be the worst for a coming cataclysm, and that's a reasonable position to take. Food, all of the other essentials for life that one might need for you and your family. Here's the question I have, John. Let's assume the worst occurs. Let's assume that you and your family manage to find a reasonably safe place with a store of food and the ability to maintain life at some reasonably comfortable level. When there are millions of others who did not prepare and come to forcibly take what is yours, what are you prepared to do about that, if anything?
You know, that's an outstanding insight, because that's where I feel I'm at right now. I'm in a large, medium-sized city environment, a very wonderful place to live, by the way. And one of my concerns is I would not use any type of force personally. Not that I'm a pacifist, I would defend myself if that was necessary or my family, but I mean, you know, I'm the type of person, if I have something, I'll share half of it with you. And the point is, I want to circumvent that scenario, Art, and so the area that I'm talking about, and I don't want to release, I'm not trying to sound mystical, but I'm not going to identify
as
using an area that a lot of professional people are investing a lot of money in.
I don't blame you, John.
Land, okay?
I don't blame you.
Okay.
But I, without any shadow of a doubt, and I would like to believe that we could prepare sufficient numbers of people so that that would not come to pass. But, John, that's not the way the world works. And if you have something and there's truly a cataclysm going on, well, gee, with Katrina we saw it, and with other disasters we've seen it, it quickly all goes wrong, John. And they try and take from those who have. Those who do not have will come to take what you have. And
that's,
you say you're not, you know, you would share
that.
Half of what you've got, right? You said that, but
yeah, absolutely.
How many times?
Yeah, what you have to do, Art, I think, is, you know, you have to find areas that are so isolated at the moment that may seem even undesirable to a lot of people. And I'm talking about, you know, having a perimeter of, you know, almost like you do with Death Valley. I mean, that's just, you know, that's just a natural buffer. That's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about perimeter fences. I'm talking about a natural landscape that would be so rustic and so rugged. And if you put yourself in the middle of it and you could sustain yourself, you know, that would be, in my opinion, the ideal situation, where you're living in an environment that you love anyway, and you're doing more, you might say, what the Native American community does on reservations today in remote parts of this country, in the, you know, in the Southwest, for example, or in the Northwest.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking about a clear field of fire, John.
That's what I thought you were talking
serious.
About.
Serious? Yeah, I'm serious.
Yeah, I know you are.
In other words, you could only share half of what you've got with how many people before you didn't have?
You'd have probably a day or two worth of rations, even if you had a lot, right, in a time of crisis. And that's what I am concerned about. That's why I say, you know, I know that being in a city would not be the ideal situation. You really need to isolate yourself in a small town where everybody knows your name.
And even then, you're going to need a clear field of fire, and I'm not joking. You're absolutely going to have to protect yourself in that way. Are you prepared to do that if need be?
Yes, if need be. You know, I'm an ex-military man. I'm an ex-lieutenant, combat electronics officer, and former enlisted man as well. So, yeah, in terms of what you're talking about of a field of fire, I can relate to that. But I feel that at some point, you know, you'd have to really deal with some of these issues that we're talking about long before they come about. And, you know, if you don't prepare for them, of course, then you would find yourself probably in a tight situation where you might panic. And that's what I'm saying here this evening to everyone listening to us. let's think through everything that could go wrong. Like a good scientist or an engineer, you know, in electronics, we call this worst-case design, right? Worst-case analysis. How many things can fail, and they will fail at the most inopportune times, according to Murphy's Law. And so back yourself up. You know, you have redundant systems. And I realize this is not something that everyone can do. And I, you know, my heart goes out to folks listening that say, I don't have the resources to do anything. I understand that. But one of the things I did when I wrote my book, I get a lot of positive feedback. I think it's a very optimistic yet realistic book. And I really want to pick everybody up. I don't want to bring anyone down. So to me, though, and the reason I'm talking with you this evening and why I feel so strongly about this is I think we really need to wake up. We need to really understand we're in the thick of it now. This is not some type of, thing that is not going to manifest. We're in it right now, I feel, and it's going to accelerate tremendously in the next few years.
John, how much do you think that our government is aware of?
You know, I have people in government that are friends and former colleagues. I think at the mid-management level, they don't have a clue. Now, are there some think tanks, some folks at the very top level that just think about crises and what they would do to control populations? Of course, they run these scenarios, worst case scenarios, all the time. But then, as we saw in Katrina, if you don't execute the plan, and if you don't have managers that have been on board at the senior level long enough to understand the drill, then you're going to fall apart at the seams right from the beginning, which happened clearly during that fiasco. So again, you know, what do we do in the military? Aren't we train and train and train and hope we never have to execute the plan?
Mm-hmm. Do you think that since Katrina, we have put something in place that is sufficient to deal with what you and others see coming?
I think we're better prepared. That would be my assessment just based on some conversations I've had with some military officers that are friends of mine. I know the military, you know, they really do have a handle on protecting themselves and running supplies and logistics around the country and around the world, as you well know.
Yeah, I'm not so much talking about the military protecting itself as I am.
Exactly. I think that what we would see is kind of a folding inward and protect their own type thing, and I can understand that. Hmm. But the civilian population would be left on its own, and I am concerned about that. I think the military ought to share their ideas more with city planners, with city councils, with mayors, and we should begin pulling this information together at a much rapid rate. I mean, my wife, for example, Connie, works for Spokane Community College, and she was just telling me just recently, said, John, you know, we just had our first meeting on the bird flu pandemic, and they're really starting to take this seriously, which made me feel good. But I said, where were they 2 or 3 years ago, you know, when the first outbreaks came? So, but it moves slow. You know, the wheels grind slow in government, and most of them are locked up.
Now, there was a big bird flu scare, and it didn't come to pass, really. Somehow it stayed contained, John. Why do you think that happened?
Well, I think, first of all, that our immune systems are, you know, in various states of readiness for most viral and bacterial events. You know, one of the concerns I have, by the way, for bird flu is the fact that, you know, it's an autoimmune response that's going to kill most of the folks. And, you know, it's interesting, a pandemic like bird flu will come in probably three waves. The first wave will be like in the spring of a given year. There'll be about a 6 to 9 month lull. And the second wave of three waves is the most lethal, according to the 1918 pandemic and other data that we've collected on these viral, outbreaks. And the lethal rate is within the 20 to 30-year-olds. Now, isn't that interesting? It's not the infants. It's not the elderly, per se, though everyone would be impacted in that age group as well, because out of there'd be 100% infection rate, according to some models, but only 50% will ever have symptoms. This has been pretty standard now with these types of pandemics. So the point is that what stops it is our immune system, but those that are healthiest among us, their immune system will overreact, and that will be what indeed kills them.
All right. Hold it right there. John J. Harper is my guest. We're talking about coming cataclysms. If you believe even half of it, you should be getting ready. I'm Art Bell. John J. Harper is my guest. From any number of points of view, he thinks the immediate future is a little dim. And indeed, it may be. Are you prepared? What are you doing for your family? What do you have stored? What do you have ready? Do you have food and water for a period of time to keep your family safe? And if so, what period of time might you have to keep them safe? A good question from Mr. Harper in a moment. John, how much preparation, how much food, for how long do you think you might have to prepare to be safe for you and your family?
You know, I've given that a lot of thought, and I believe that we probably should be thinking that, you know, if we lost a growing season, for example, what would that take? Because I think we're pretty resilient, and I think we would band together. Again, I'm an optimistic person, but I really see us not, you know, paying attention to the, quote, signs of the times. And this really alarms me because, as you said, you brought up a very good perspective. What would we do if we were caught flat-footed and, you know, we looked at our neighbors going hungry while, say, we wined and dined? Of course, I don't think that most of us would hesitate. We would share to a certain extent what we have. But, again, what's the worst case? The worst case, I think we're going to lose a growing season. Then we might see a good season. Then maybe we'll lose two. So, but if we can get into this rotation idea that, you know, we're going to need to take care of ourselves for maybe 6 months at least, I think we'll be ahead of the curve from what I can see now. But one thing, Art, I'd like to share real quick, and that is how to boost our immune system, because stress is going to kill more of us probably than all the natural disasters combined. Stress is going to, I think, accelerate. When the energies increase in the earth, they're going to impact consciousness and the biological system that upholds consciousness. In other words, our human cellular body. And what I've done for years is investigate optimal wellness products. And I'm not going to give any brand names. I'm not here to promote any one particular product. However, there are certain items that you can investigate for yourself on the internet. But one thing that will fight infection in the lungs, for example, is an antibacterial, antiviral agent. And I take it, my wife takes it, and my children take it. It's a flaxseed oil. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners are aware of this. But look into that. There's another thing, just an elderberry extract that's made in Israel. But if you probably just Google that, you'll come up with different products. But there's one particular product, and you'll see it, that's made by a virologist who has some data that shows this will protect you better than Tamiflu for infection with the avian flu virus. So, again, these types of things, vitamin C, for example, taken in a powdered form.
Right.
And there's many others, right, Art? I mean, there's a lot of things out there that we can do for ourselves to – it's just like when you fly. I used to fly – almost for a living as an engineer. I would be in a meeting in L.A. one minute, Seattle the next, and have to fly to New Jersey the next. So I was constantly getting colds, constantly getting sick.
That's right.
I boost my immune system.
All right. Here's something, John, that maybe you can answer, because I sure can't. As you know, I just got back from living in the Philippines for 8 months. Now, as a result of my international flights, I managed to get the flu on my way over. And I caught several consecutive colds, no doubt being exposed, you know, to viruses there that are not here. And fortunately, in the Philippines, you can walk into a drugstore and you can ask for antibiotics and you'll get them without a doctor. You can walk into a drugstore and you can ask for Tamiflu, John, and pay and get it without the permission of a doctor. And somehow civilization does not collapse there. They don't have Tamiflu junkies buying all the Tamiflu they can. They don't have antibiotic junkies trying to get all the antibiotic they can. And civilization goes on without a problem there. Now, I understand that physicians overprescribe antibiotics, But I don't think people would rush into drugstores if they could get it without a prescription and just, you know, for example, buy Tamiflu and start gobbling it up, forming some sort of Tamiflu habit. Do you?
No, I do not. And I certainly believe in educating a public that is more than hungry for knowledge about how to self-medicate in a correct way. I mean, you know, I have worked in medical clinics, and, you know, I am very open to things that my colleague, Dr. Bruce Lipton, the cell biologist, it talks about. I'm all about self-empowerment, all about boosting the immune system through, you know, positive thinking and these types of things. But I've heard so much of this stuff that I realize that most of us are walking around in some type of fog, and when the shift hits the fan, we're not going to be able, you know, to pull our head out of our past fast enough.
And for the record, that was S-H-I-F-T, shift, he
and
said.
And P-A-S-T.
Yes.
And so we are going to see a crisis compounded by panic, I'm afraid, and I want to do what I can to prepare people for what I see is coming. And that's why I took 15 years to write my book. And I want to thank you, Art, for your show in 1999 with Joe Firmage. Joe Firmage gets a big pat on the back. He funded me for a year that really bought the computers, bought me the research documents, and everything that really led to the publication of my book in 2006. And it's because of shows like yours, Art, and I really feel we're really getting down to it tonight. I mean, we started at a mind-to-mind kind of level talking about this topic. I feel the heart-to-heart connection with you, certainly, and I know there are millions of people out here tonight that really are wanting answers. They want to prepare for what's coming, and they want community back. They really want to feel connected, not only with nature, but with one another, and I think this is such an important dialogue that we're having right now.
Well, I think Katrina woke a lot of people up, a lot of people who were comfortably living with the concept that the government would rush in at the first sign of any catastrophic occurrence, whatever it might be, and save their butts. Katrina woke them up, and they watched on a daily basis people trying to survive in the New Orleans area without any help from anybody, finally shocked about it. It was a big controversy, but the end result was that I think an awful lot of people out there figured out they're going to have to stand on their own if something comes down.
Absolutely. Let me share a quick insight on this topic. I was recently, looking for property and talking with realtors and other people in different parts of the country. And what I was amazed was I kept hearing, well, you know, so-and-so just bought into there, and they're from Florida, and they're leaving Florida in droves. Oh, these people, they got caught in Louisiana or Mississippi or on the Gulf Coast. They want as far away from there as they can. Interesting that right now there's a sense, I think it's like it was a shock and then a recovery from the post-traumatic stress disorder that being relocated that suddenly happened to so many. And now they're trying to find, quote, safe places. They've been traumatized, in other words. And again, this is what I'm trying for the vast majority that hear our voices tonight, I'm hoping that some of us will take action. Maybe we don't have to go anywhere. Maybe we just need to dig in and reinforce our community values and talk about this more so that we don't get caught off guard.
I don't know, John. How many lived within the sphere of Katrina hitting who have moved out of the area and are not going back?
I'd like to see that government statistic on the next census. I would have to imagine there must be hundreds of thousands of people that will never go back and live
in the exact
residence that they lived in before.
That's exactly right. Some because they can't, some because they just don't want to go through something like that again.
Well, look what Max Mayfield said in his retirement sign-off from the National Hurricane Center a couple weeks ago. He said, we are going to face a catastrophe unknown to this country if we don't get people off the coastlines and prepare for the inevitable Category 5-plus hurricane.
Mm-hmm. Well, for the most part, they're not leaving. Yes, in New Orleans, where they experienced this. In Florida, where they had a horrible hurricane season, not this last year, but the previous. Many have left, and I think had there been a repeat of the hurricane season, there was a respite. But I can assure you, not globally, because, John, where I went, in the Philippines, everything that didn't happen to the U.S. East Coast did happen to the Philippines in one typhoon after another, after another, after another. There was always one on the map headed toward us. So what didn't occur in the Atlantic, I can assure you, did occur in the Pacific.
And what's important, I think, to really focus on that particular topic, you know, I've been asked before, folks trying to corner me and say, you know, they predicted, the National Weather Bureau predicted massive hurricane season last year. It did not materialize. And they said, you know, so in other words, you know, this doom and gloom scenario, and I'm not one of those, but I certainly want to be realistic about the data. And I said, no, what that proves is that we're going into a cycle of chaos. And the mathematical models that are in our computers no longer are plotting real data, and we are headed for a time of unpredictability.
Well, we've certainly achieved that.
Yes, we have.
No question. All right, so the coming solar cycle is going to be a real whopper. Are we going to see sun flares that go up to the top of the scale, or perhaps even the new scale? I mean, the old scale was certainly exceeded. They never expected. The scientists said, can't have one that big. There cannot be that much energy from the sun. So when they designed the satellite, it only had a top range of so much. Well, it pegged out. It pegged out so badly, they don't even really know exactly how big it was, just that it was too big for their instruments to measure.
That's correct. They, you know, some plotted around X28. Others said it had to be an X40. And you say, like I say, it went off the scale. Now, you know, we have these on a kind of a routine basis. I mean, in terms of solar flares, but most of them are not Earth directed. So what we're talking about here, of course, is are we going to have a solar maximum and have all the alignments that we're talking about, the galactic alignment, the Earth centered and positioned in such a way that it's going to resonantly, you know, people are thinking energy transferring across this vast space. You know, they're losing the idea of resonance, in electronics, and the fact that, you know, if you tune an antenna, you know, when I was a kid back in the 50s, and, you know, an airplane would fly over or a car would go by, you know, the whole screen went screwy on you, and you take the old rabbit ears antenna and shift a little bit, and you'd get that, you know, that harmonic resonance back, and that oscillator tuning effect, and that's what I'm talking about. So I want to be clear about that. You know, if we get coupled in that kind of way with one of these flares, or even X28, it's going to take everything to the ground electronically, like it did in 1989 in Quebec.
Well, it's kind of like Russian roulette, John. In other words, the sun's position when it lets go with one of these monsters. Now, had that X40 or what, 48 or whatever it was, been Earth-directed, it would have, as you just said, taken everything down to the ground. The satellites would have gone, power grids would have gone, communication would have ceased. It really would have fried us in a very effective way. And one of these days, particularly, for example, during this next big solar cycle that you've been talking about, the bullet's going to be in the chamber as it's pointed toward Earth. It's just going to happen, John. That's all there is to it.
That's what I'm sensing too, Art. And, you know, I continually go back and revisit everything that I've said in my book, everything that I hear folks on your show, for example, that I respect. You have a lot of wonderful guests, very knowledgeable people sharing information today. And you know what? I cannot honestly discount what I've written. I cannot discount the passion that I feel about warning folks that we need to prepare. For some reason, I feel that this is the time that we need to pull all this information together and act on it. In other words, we've been collecting data night after night on the Coast to Coast AM show, and we've been doing a really good job of it, you guys. And the thing of it is, now what are we going to do with it? What kind of bundle are we going to put this together in? And is there something that we can do that we need to do? And in my opinion, yes, we need to realize we need to take care of our health. We need to boost our immune system for the most part. We need to think about our diet. What kind of foods can we live on and do it comfortably and live, you know, pretty much the same lifestyle? But maybe there's a lot of things we don't need right now. I would start saying, I'm doing this. Start simplifying and getting it simpler and simpler and simpler to the point you know you can survive on oatmeal for a few days. You know that you can survive on chili for a few days, for example. But, I mean, realistically, you know, I've got 11 mouths to feed. You know, things go bad because I've got my son-in-law
11?
In Iraq.
11, John?
I've got 3 adult kids and 8 grandkids, and I've got a son-in-law in Iraq, so those 4 kids are with me.
Okay. Your book is named...
Transformers, Shamans of the 21st Century.
And it's been out how long?
1 year right now.
January. Okay, how has your book done?
It's done extremely well, and I'm very grateful. And your listeners have really come through. I get emails when I speak with you folks that just, you know, tear at my heart. They are just wonderful people. I've had the best conversations with so many of them. And I just want to say thank you, Coast to Coast AM, and all your listeners, I think, really have some ideas that we need to listen to. I'm really looking forward to the next segment. I would love to hear what folks are doing to prepare for the earth changes.
All right. We know the coastlines are going to be dangerous areas in the years ahead, John. Where would you say the safer areas would be?
Certainly up in the northern tier of the United States, not maybe all the way to the Canadian border like where I am. I'm an hour from Canada, but certainly in the interstate regions, you know, from, like I say, so maybe from Spokane, Lake Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, all the way across the country up to about the Great Lakes. So, you know, we're talking maybe to Wisconsin area. And there's, of course, great areas in the south and the Midwest, I think. But, you know, if you're by a major river system that can flood, we saw what can happen, you know, a decade ago with major floods. We also want to realize that, you know, the weather can turn so quickly now. What's your water source, you know, for example? Where's your nearest medical facility? So you don't want to become so isolated that you literally can't get to, you know, community services if they exist. But those are some of the things I'm looking at right now, in fact, Art.
Well, if you're in a city, John, a big city, you can expect that those medical facilities, if there's some catastrophic event, are going to be overwhelmed very quickly.
Absolutely. I live in the medical district of Spokane on South Hill. I'm right here with Sacred Heart and Deaconess and all the major medical facilities well-known in this country. And I would think that within 4 hours to 8 hours, they would be completely overwhelmed and probably under quarantine. So what do you do? And that is the types of things that I've, you know, evaluated and I look at continuously. And I think if you can, it would be wise to relocate to a smaller community.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And as you point out, water is a key. Any suggestions on water? I mean, it is the basic of life.
Well, what I'm looking at is I'm trying to find parts of the country that have natural flowing streams and creeks that are still relatively clean. And there are a lot of them, Art. It's amazing when you get into some of these hinterlands, you know, in the Midwest and the Southeast and that type of thing, the upper Midwest. There's some marvelous places that I think people haven't even probably considered for a long time. In other words, they moved out during the manufacturing era and probably have their roots back there. But I'm thinking that maybe a lot of us ought to rethink about where we're from. Where did our grandparents start out, for example, or great-grandparents? Maybe those communities are something we need to revisit, take a look at, and maybe revitalize.
Perhaps so. We live in an area here in the middle of the desert where you wouldn't think it's true, and we have one of the, I think, second or third largest aquifers running directly underneath us in this otherwise very dry desert. So our water is superb and available, and as long as you have a way to pump it from the ground, as in solar or wind power, then you're in pretty good shape if something happens.
Yes, that's an excellent idea to look for these natural aquifers, and there are many throughout the country. In fact, Spokane also sits on a huge underground lake and has some of the finest drinking water that I've ever had, and I'm from the Northwest, and I've lived in other parts of the country, so I can really appreciate good water.
All right, John, coming up in a moment, we're going to turn you over to the audience, all right? Good. Stay right where you are. I'm Art Bell.